This is the In Focus podcast from The Hindu.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the In Focus podcast. I'm your host, G. Sampath. The Foreign Contribution Regulation Act, or the FCRA, has been in the news once again. India's NGO sector had an unpleasant start to the new year as it emerged that around 6,000 of them, perhaps more, had lost their FCRA license. Among those that lost their licenses are some really big names such as Mother Teresa's Missionaries of Charity, Oxfam, the Indian Medical Association and the Tuberculosis Association of India. While the FCRA license of Missionaries of Charities and a couple of others have been restored, most of the others are still looking for ways to get back their licenses. And just to add some context here, NGOs and other institutions that do charitable work have to register under the FCRA to be able to receive foreign donations. So a cancellation or the loss of an FCRA license could mean that they may no longer be able to continue their day-to-day work to pay salaries and may even be forced to shut down. So this also has livelihood implications for people employed in the social sector. In this edition of In Focus, we're going to get to the bottom of the whole FCRA phenomenon. Why do NGOs need an FCRA license? Do other entities that receive donations, such as political parties, for example, face the same level of regulatory scrutiny? And how transparent is the process of granting or cancellation of licenses? For a better understanding of these questions and more, we have with us Kabir Dixit, an advocate on record at the Supreme Court who has been handling FCRA matters before the Supreme Court and the Delhi High Court for almost a decade. Kabir, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Sampath. It's a pleasure.
Kabir, to start with, let's get some background and history into the picture. What we know is that Indian NGOs need FCRA registration to receive foreign donations. This law has been around since 1976 and has been amended repeatedly, with the latest set of amendments coming in 2020. So can you give us a quick historical overview of this law and what it's been about?
Sure. So FCRA's history is absolutely fascinating. It maps perfectly with three major setbacks to democracy in India and the world. First, the emergency. The law was born in 1976 during the emergency in a parliament empty of opposition. At first, when this law was introduced, the NGOs were only supposed to report the funds received and spent. There were no major restrictions. But once the party came back, Congress came back in power, on the pretext of investigating Jayaprakash Narayan's foreign funds, it set up a commission under Justice P.D. Kudal, a former judge of Rajasthan High Court. That commission was meant to look only into, say, four or five NGOs, but it became a roving inquiry into hundreds of NGOs, and the terms kept getting extended. Ultimately, over seven installments over 3 years, it filed its reports. And basis that, an ordinance was passed in 1984, making several changes in the 1976 Act. Now, it was hardened substantially, and NGOs were required to, for the first time, register or obtain prior permission to receive foreign funds. And, remarkably, they were not allowed to pass their funds to other non-registered NGOs. This has happened recently, and there was a lot of hue and cry, but this happened back then. So this was the first, the genesis lies in the emergency. The second big milestone in the history of FCRA would be the September 11 attacks, where post that there was a global sort of backsliding in democracies across the world. And some charities were implicated in that attack, and then the US passed the Patriot Act. There was the Financial Action Task Force, which is an international regime. It issued a special report on combating the abuse of nonprofits for terror financing, the Recommendation 8, it's known as. And India passed, say, Money Laundering Act 2002. FCRA bill was introduced in 2006. Finally, it was passed in 2010 after it went through a standing committee of Home Affairs. Comments were invited, public hearings were granted. In 2011, when the rules had not yet been framed, the US had shown some concern about the slow pace of FCRA implementation in the country. So this was the second stage of evolution. where the FCRA 2010 law came, post the 1976, which was repealed. The third major stage that we are currently in has come with the election of this present dispensation, what's called known as Modi government. Two major amendments have happened in 2018 and 2020, which have sort of transformed the nature of this law and what's happening under its ambit. And these are, in my opinion, the most damaging, even more damaging. The law was problematic, but now it's in its most damaging phase. In 2018, the amendment that was introduced did something remarkable. The law has been put in place essentially, if you read the provisions of the law, to protect the Indian electoral democracy, the sanctity of that, to protect the Indian public sphere from being tainted by foreign influence through foreign funding. However, in 2018, the amendment that has come has allowed political parties to receive foreign funding in the most opaque manner through the route of electoral bonds. Now, what is striking is, as far as NGOs are concerned, their foreign funding is only meant to be regulated by the Act. However, a few categories of persons are completely banned under the FCRA Act from receiving any foreign funding. And political parties, candidates in elections, and legislators, elected legislators, are under the prohibited category. So this amendment has transformed the nature of this Act, where those prohibited can now get foreign funds, and those who are only meant to be regulated are being harassed. And the biggest tool of that harassment is the 2020 amendment, which we shall discuss later. So that was the brief historical overview that I wanted to give.
Right, that's an interesting distinction that you're making, that on the one hand, you have entities who are prohibited from getting foreign funds, such as political parties, now getting foreign funds, seemingly endless amounts through this opaque device of the electoral bonds. And on the other hand, NGOs who are only supposed to be regulated are now facing the kind of harassment which basically sort of shuts the tap on foreign funding. Now, going back a little bit, you said something about in 2010-11, the US expressing concerns over a lax implementation of the FCRA Act. Is that right? Did I hear that right? The US expressed concerns?
Yes, there have been reports about this sort of concern being expressed, yes.
Over a domestic law in India?
Yes. Very briefly, see, the Prevention of Money Laundering Act and FCRA, these sort of these laws under, you know, domestic regimes all connect back to a global enterprise to counter financial terrorism, to fight terrorism. RBI has its own notifications that it comes out under the countering of financial terrorism and money laundering rules. So therefore, that is the global context of it.
Right. Okay, now we have some clear roadmap in terms of what happened historically before the present moment. But just taking it a step further at a general level, do NGOs under the Constitution have an automatic right to receive foreign contributions, or does the FCRA law confer this right?
I'm really grateful for that question, because this is a very common misunderstanding. A lot of people seem to think or seem to articulate when FCRA-related debates happen that organizations have no right to receive foreign contribution. Now, this is wrong. While it is true that the Foreign Contribution Regulation Act does not confer this right, it only seeks to regulate receipt of foreign contribution. So therefore, FCRA is clearly not, the right to receive foreign funding is clearly not a statutory right under the FCRA. This right traces back to the freedom of association, the right to freedom of expression, the right of individuals and citizens to go about doing exactly what they wish to do in terms of work, in the area of work that they choose to operate in. And these are fundamental rights that are recognized in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, in the International Covenant for Civil and Political Rights, in most international treaty bodies and international conventions, whether in the Americas, Africa, Europe. Across the world, this right to freely associate and the right to collaborate financially with like-minded people and organizations, wherever they may be in the world, is essentially a part of the bundle of rights to associate, you know. And the Indian Constitution recognizes the right to form associations, but the sad part is that this right to form associations in the manner articulated is a lot of times perceived in a very restricted sense as a right merely to form associations. However, if given its actual meaning, if understood broadly in the international context, then this right to receive foreign funding is an inherent part of our right to freely associate.
Right. I mean, this is something which I at least haven't heard being mentioned very often, that the right to receive foreign contribution is associated or sort of stems from the right to free association. And that is a fundamental right. And so then what kind of lens does this put the FCRA law under? Is there really then a logic at all, or what kind of logic that goes behind subjecting NGOs to an FCRA regime?
Well, in its present form, I will have to say that in its present form, which is an extremely invasive, interfering, restrictive form, which lends itself to abuse, there are many vague, unacceptable provisions. In this present form, the FCRA law does not seem to have any rationale. The big difficulty with this law is that the government tries to pass it off as a national security legislation, right? But if we look at, for instance, if an NGO or any organization is involved in illegal activities, there are laws for that. There's the Penal Code, there's the UAPA, Unlawful Activities Prevention Act. If there are risks or, you know, threats of money laundering, if some organization is involved in that, there is a Prevention of Money Laundering Act for that, right? For reporting of receipts, there is RBI, there are laws regulating the banking system. So therefore, once you look at the entire gamut of laws to which any organization receiving foreign fund is subjected to anyway, then what remains in FCRA is barely anything. And therefore, there is probably scope for only a very bare skeletal legislation. But in its present form, for instance, you know, there is no scope for this, because there's a provision, for instance, which says that assets built from foreign contribution must vest in the state once the registration is either cancelled or surrendered. Now, imagine a minority institution sets up a science lab or a computer lab in a village with foreign funds. Why should it vest in the government upon surrender of registration? Why can't the institute run it? So these kind of, you know, these provisions have not been thought through, and they seem to be lack any sound legal basis as well, and they've not been tested in court as yet.
Right. So coming back to the current scenario, is the FCRA meant exclusively for NGOs only, or entities that do charitable work only, or are there also other entities which obtain or lose their license to receive foreign funds under FCRA?
So under the FCRA law per se, organizations, effectively it would be NGOs only, because if you see, we have current account convertibility, so any import of goods and services is pretty much free in this country. So if people are rendering services abroad and receiving remittances, that's not a foreign contribution, that's not donation, that's exempt. Similarly, on capital account fronts, if companies are getting foreign direct investment into equity, or they are raising loans from abroad, that is also not under the purview of foreign contribution. Foreign contribution is basically donations, grants received by organizations. And in effect, it only sort of, for practical purposes, it's only NGOs, trusts, societies, Section 8 companies.
Right. So the issue is not so much with foreign money per se, but foreign donations. And that means that basically it's the social sector and civil society groups, or rather those who are not in the commercial or profit-making domain, which are affected by this legislation.
With one exception, of course, I forgot to add that political parties, of course, were under blanket prohibition. Candidates for election, I mentioned earlier, and elected legislators. Also, judges, journalists, editors, bureaucrats, public servants. So the idea behind the law is that civil society can continue to function and receive foreign contribution, and that can be regulated. with transparency. But all these higher, constitutional functionaries or those who govern public opinion or are part of the electoral politics, active politics, must be completely, protected from the influence of foreign money, which of course now has been upturned.
Right. Getting to the nitty-gritty of it, what is the exact process by which the state can legitimately deny or cancel or refuse to renew an FCRA license, and how transparent or not is this process of cancellation and granting licenses?
Well, the cancellation process, the grounds on which organization which has FCRA registration can be cancelled is if they have violated some provisions of the law, or they have made some false statement in its application for registration, or discontinued operations. That a large number of organizations that lose FCRA license, and then these news reports come out, many of them have perhaps discontinued continued operations, or some of them may have stopped taking foreign contribution and therefore not made relevant filings. That also happens sometimes. And registration can also be cancelled if the government perceives that it is against public interest that it receives foreign funds, a particular organization. This, in my opinion, is vague and is also abused by the government, this vagueness. The process, of course, itself is not uniformly transparent in my experience.
We keep hearing about this adverse input, so-called, from wherever it comes from. In the case of Missionaries of Charity, they said they did received adverse inputs. And what does it mean?
A lot of language that is very alarmist and sounds very ominous and dangerous, is deployed by the government. It's if it didn't have such serious consequences for the organizations, their project and livelihood, it would be comic. Because when organizations, the government on its part, when it has to proceed, a lot of times we see that principles of natural justice, like giving a proper notice, disclosing proper reasons, affording an opportunity of hearing, these are disregarded, bypassed, and organizations are sort of compelled to waste a lot of time and money in litigation, pursuing their remedies in court. But when they go to the court, they are faced with a very difficult situation, because the government insists on relying on sealed covers. It will say that, there's this adverse material that cannot be disclosed. And peculiarly, the organizations, a lot of these respectable entities who have a great track record of doing good work in the country and have great international and national credibility, they may have in some instances worked with the government, they are rarely ever reluctant to share all the material and have it discussed in the public domain. But the government sometimes insists, on producing material only in sealed cover to sort of drag on the proceedings. And, delay is one of the biggest deterrents for seeking judicial review of these actions, because a recent amendment in 2020 has extended the period of suspension from 180 days pre-amendment position to 360 days post-amendment. Now, how many organizations in the country can afford legal costs and this kind of time? Where will they pay salaries from? Will they not lose staff, key personnel? Will their projects not die a slow death? Will they not lose credibility? How many people, how many donors, in fact, would want to associate with organizations once it is clear that they are in government crosshairs and the government is not going to let them function anymore? So these kind of practical difficulties arise unless the courts, of course, provide the necessary protections to NGOs approaching the court. I don't see this problem getting solved very easily, and that doesn't happen uniformly or consistently.
Right. You just referred to the 2020 amendment to the FCRA law. I mean, does this amendment have anything at all to do with all of a sudden so many NGOs losing their FCRA licenses altogether?
Absolutely. Most certainly this amendment has something to do with this, especially when it comes to renewals. Now, prior to this amendment, the renewal regime under the Foreign Contribution Regulation Act was reassuringly simple. A renewal was to be granted unless there was an FCRA violation by the organization. And it had to be granted in a time-bound fashion. And this was, of course, a very good provision. However, the amendment was brought in to make the renewal subject to various conditions. The scrutiny will now look at things as vague as whether office bearers have of an organization seeking renewal have any prosecution pending against them. Now, if you look by contrast, elected members of parliament and state legislatures can become and continue as ministers and lawmakers even when they are they've been charge sheeted until they're convicted of heinous crimes, very, very heinous crimes. And an organization can lose FCRA registration if, say, its treasurer or someone has been just, found protesting, joining a peaceful protest march against some legal, some action, some law, or, it could be as something as small as a traffic violation. So these sort of things, of course, have caused a great amount of distress. And some of these cases might owe, to these kind of amendments, problematic amendments.
Right. So now that so many NGOs have lost their licenses, is there a scope for these cancellations or losses of FCRA licenses to be challenged in court? Is it happening?
It is happening. And of course, individual actions, individual cancellations, refusals of renewal must be challenged individually by those particular organizations. And they will have to be tested on the facts of each particular case. But the offensive provisions, vague provisions, provisions that are, being abused or that by, there are such provisions which just by existing on the statute books cause a chilling effect or are calculated to sort of weed out critical voices from the civil society, ensure that they don't find employment or such organizations do not continue. Those provisions can be challenged individually as well as collectively and are being challenged. But there can be more challenges here.
So, what kind of provisions, in your opinion, have a chilling effect? I read somewhere about a provision which requires, say, someone who's on the board of a particular NGO, all the directors have to sort of share all their financial records and Aadhaar card and all those other details. Is that something one should worry about here?
Absolutely. With the multiple such provisions, I mentioned one about prosecution for any offense or vague, disqualification criteria, public interest, or where organizations cannot sort of decide. Everyone's on, tenterhooks, not knowing how to act, and the government has exceedingly wide powers, and there aren't enough safeguards built into the provisions to ensure due process. So these kind of provisions, there are multiple such provisions, and they can be challenged.
Right. And one of the things we keep reading about in news reports whenever we see an NGO's FCRA license getting cancelled is that the government has often been reported as saying that the NGO funds, especially the funds received from abroad, are not being utilized for the purpose for which they were donated. Now, according to you, do you think it's the government's remit to look into how an NGO is using its funds? Aren't there donors already out there? The people who gave those funds would be doing that job for themselves?
Without a doubt, it's not the government's remit to do that. And the entire idea behind this is to retain the power to go after NGOs that are critical of government policies. There is no other justification for retaining such powers.
Okay, but isn't there also a case to be made that some would argue that the government's fears about foreign funding might be justified because it could be used by anti-national forces, etc. So, do you think there is some credibility to that, or is it just a matter of prejudice against foreign funding in the social sector?
See, my take on this is that Recommendation 8 of the Financial Action Task Force that I'd mentioned earlier, that came as far back as 2002. It was revised in 2013. Some time has passed now. The FCRA law is also over a decade old now. Where is the empirical evidence showing that Indian NGOs or a significant minority even has posed the risk of being conduits of financial terrorism or large-scale conversion or any threat to national security? Where are the credible prosecutions, investigations, convictions? Is there any such data shared by the government? placed before the parliament, the entire FCRA regime is based on unfounded suspicions. It is based on creation of prejudice against foreign-funded NGOs by a foreign-funded government that does not want to be exposed on various counts or criticized even. That's the difficulty.
Right. Okay, we are running out of time. Kabir, one last question before we wind up. Just to come back to one general sort of theme around this discourse of FCRA, what is wrong with the view that says, okay, let the NGOs and civil society organizations operate on the funds they raise within the country? Why do they need foreign funds? If they're really doing good work, then they should raise contributions from their fellow citizens instead of getting money from foreign sources, which may or may not be conduits for international forces. Raise money within the country. Don't look outside. What's wrong with this view?
Well, see, this is a very difficult and a very common objection that is raised. And it is unrealistic, you know. It is there are multiple ways to approach it. One very obvious thing is that there are a lot of causes which don't always find, you know, a lot of social work that is being done by reputed organizations is sometimes they're working on causes that are not popular causes. Not everyone is just planting trees, you know. Sometimes, for instance, the this is just a hypothetical example I'm giving. For instance, the movement against, you know, the laws criminalizing homosexuality had been going on for a very substantial period of time. There wasn't a lot of popular sentiment supporting that cause for the longest time. It made very slow progress till changes were brought in. Any such cause sometimes must get resources from where it can find. Where educated, like-minded, resourceful organizations exist, right? Unless there is a good reason to avoid an to sort of deny an organization such association, just to say that they must operate domestically and raise funds domestically, there is no valid reason for that. The other reason that I can immediately think of is that currently you have a situation where the private sector, as I stated earlier, whether through import and export of goods and services or through FDI and external commercial borrowings, is across sector after sector, receiving a large amount of foreign money. And this foreign money comes with strings attached. It requires a return on investment, right? It comes to own assets in this country. Political parties today, they were never meant to receive foreign contribution or foreign money. They are receiving foreign money. And to bring this sort of these political parties must most legitimately be asked to operate domestically and raise resources domestically. This taints the Indian electoral process. However, to ignore all of that and to raise this threshold or subject only the Indian civil society, which is the only segment which is coming with the highest amount of transparency about where they are receiving money from, where they are spending it, and for what cause, to subject them to this sort of an objection is, hypocritical.
Right. I guess it is a matter of debate whether this fear of foreign donations is really a fear of foreign funding, given that foreign funding seems to be not a problem in the private sector, or is it really a fear of civil society itself? No, that's a subject for another podcast. But two major takeaways for me, at least, from your insightful comments and the background that you've given, Kabir, is one is, of course, I didn't know that this entire FCRA legislation was born during the emergency, which I think says a lot. And the fact that the entire right to receive donations from abroad is an integral part of the right to free association. And it is not something that is conferred by the FCRA legislation. These are really, I think, important points that we need to keep in mind as this issue develops and as public debate develops on this issue. It's been a pleasure talking to you, Kabir. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Sampath, for this opportunity. Thank you.
In Focus will be back soon with analysis of the biggest news issues. In the meantime, you can find our podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and other platforms. Just search for In Focus by The Hindu. We'll see you soon.